Well, good morning, everybody. It's great to be back in Dayton again. We spent from just after lunch, we planned to be up at the camp a little longer than that yesterday, but trying to get away from the office at home and the home office took longer than we thought. But we spent about 8 hours at camp after we got there. Got home really late last night. Things were going well. They had a few bumps and bruises, a few visits to the local clinic for health issues, bumps on the head and scratches and cuts that the nurse were beyond what her facilities there could tend to. But nothing major. One girl though from California, she was a little discouraged. Well, probably for about 5 minutes. Knowing her, she doesn't stay discouraged long. We've known the family for a long time. But she blew out her knee. Except she told me, she said, well, it happened before I got here. I did something similar, and then she was in one of the running games, just running and making a turn. She's a real athletic, fast runner. And pop goes the knee, and down she went. So doctor looked at it. He says, well, there's no major swelling and everything, she could put weight on it without intense pain after a little while. He said, but you stay off of that leg until you get back and see your own doctor and he can check it out more thoroughly. So she's gimping around on crutches when she would rather be sprinting around, which is her normal mode of transportation, but having a great time all the same. It just seems to be going very well. The positive spirit at camp was just evidenced everywhere. We were very thrilled. Got to see a lot of the campers and chat with them a little bit, and the counselors and the other staff members. Got to go coach the coach on Coach Bornhorst, the archery department there. That's one of my favorite activities to teach at camp, that and wilderness survival, but archery is probably where my heart is as far as those kinds of sports go. But the kids were having a good time and helped a couple of them work out their which hand they are. And you got teenagers that don't know if they're right-handed or left-handed. And what they really don't know after that are which eye are they dominant with, left eye or right eye. You know, but and I'm not surprised about the eye dominance because most people just don't think about that. But the left and right hand, when I taught archery over the past, you know, some years back out west, first thing I would ask after the brief greeting and the beginning of the safety lecture, I would say, okay, how many of you are right-handed? And you get the righties would go up. But how many are left-handed? We get two or three of those. How many aren't sure? And there would be two or three of those out of a dozen kids. But, you know, technology is, you know, it's one of the curses that it brings. People don't do things with their dominant hand. So they don't write very often. They text, which is, you know, doesn't use one hand over the other one, except for the mouse. That's what I should ask them. Which hand do you run your mouse with? Both. They'll tell me both. I use that little pad in the middle and bump my thumbs. Yeah, well, see, even there, the mouse is not a giveaway. So then we'd have to go through and figure out which they were. Now, there were some people who, you know, always, some who are, in fact, ambidextrous. And they're few. I knew a guy that wanted to be ambidextrous. He said he'd give his right arm if he could be ambidextrous. But a little slow on the uptake there, Nick. Anyway, we would work all that out. Then we had to decide which eye they were. I said, well, how do you do that? I said, well, point, and we just pick a corner of the room. We had a little shed that provided some shade. I said, point at the corner of the room real fast with your right hand, if you're right-handed. I say, now close, hold it there right on that spot. Now close one eye and close the other eye. Which eye is lined up with your finger and what you're pointing at? That's your dominant eye. And then they would say, well, yeah, but I don't know. I can't tell. All right, let's do the peephole. So you form a peephole between your two hands, and you line it up on something. I'm looking at the plug right underneath the bingo thing there. And I said, now you close one eye and see if it's lined up. You close the other eye, and it won't be lined up at all. So I'm right-handed and right-eye dominant, and I don't know why I started shooting a bow left-handed when I was a kid, but I can do that, but I shoot right-handed mostly. So yesterday we had a couple of the girls in the one dorm that I helped him with who were having trouble determining if they were actually right-handed, left-handed, or right or left-eyed. And I think we got it sorted out, and then they were okay. So it was a bit of fun to get to do that and to see all the other activities going on. The camp up at Katubik, for those of you who haven't seen it, is rolling hills with several large, well, we would have called them ponds where I grew up, but they're lakes here in Ohio. This is one of the few states that has absolutely no, zero lakes, natural lakes. We don't have a single one. Everything we have is an impoundment. You know, a dam has been built. The only thing we can claim as a lake is Erie, but we can only claim our side of it. You know, and then the rest of it gets claimed by Michigan and Canada and whoever else. But one's fairly large. I would guess it's around 6 or 7 acres, and that's the main one where they swim and do their water sports, and they had a great time there. They have softball, beautiful rolling fields for softball or for speedway, which is a cross between soccer and volleyball. The kids can explain what speedway is. It's a combination sport. It reminds me of Aussie rules football without the violence. Australian rules football is a mix of American gridiron, as they call our football. What we call football is not football anywhere else in the world. Everywhere in the world, football is soccer. And we're the only people that call it soccer, you know, because we think that America leads everybody. Well, on those two points, it doesn't. So Australian rules football is part soccer, part American gridiron, part volleyball, part rugby, and I think there's something, yes, part basketball. You can carry the ball, which you can't do in soccer. You can carry the ball, but you have to dribble it every 10 steps. You have to bounce it off the ground again to keep running. You can pass it like gridiron, except not a forward pass. You have to do the lateral pass, somebody behind you, which you can do in American football. Rarely is that done. They all want the long bomb down to the goalpost. But the other thing that you can do is a forward pass, which is part football and part volleyball, because you take the ball, hold it up on your hand, and smack it like that. And these guys play rugby the rest of the year, so they're tough, and they can really hit a ball a long way off their hand like that with the heel of their palm. But the ball itself is actually a rugby ball, which looks like an American football that's got round ends. So, and on top of that, I only saw one game of this. I don't know why I'm even telling you about it. It was in London when I was at Ambassador College, and I found out that Australian rules football is played on a cricket pitch, a field where you play cricket. They call them pitches in the British nations. So it even mixes in there, too, which is it's kind of an oval-type shaped field. Fortunately, I was sitting between two Australians, and they were explaining the rules at rapid fire as we were going along, and I sort of got a sense of the game. And that was fun. Then camp is fun, and I'm happy to see the camp program going as well as it is in Katubik, especially. Just a really, really beautiful camp. We could play cricket there. They've got an extra field that isn't being used for anything. They could play cricket. We wouldn't probably let them play Australian rules football because of the tackling and that kind of thing, but they could do cricket. They could do a lot of other things. But we have them as busy as we can have them right now, and I'm looking forward to hearing the reports of the camps as the summer goes on. Please be sure to pray for, you know, God's blessing of safety and then his blessing of instruction, because camp is a wonderful learning time. We talk about the term, we used it on a camp video one time a few years ago, called immersion instruction. And that's what the camp is. For, you know, a whole week, for 24 hours a day, they're immersed in learning God's way of life and building friendships in the faith and talking about God's way. But 24/7, they're in the dorms, at the dinners, or the breakfasts, out in the activity fields, or in the gymnasiums, or in the Bible classes, and the Christian living classes. Everything is about learning about God and his way and bonding together as part of his people. So it's a huge teaching time, one of our most valuable teaching weeks for our youth in the year. And the next one, which rivals it and maybe is even more potent because it takes us all the rest of us in, and that's the Feast of Tabernacles, which is also an immersion instruction program. And all that training eventually produces strong young men and women who can be good fathers and good mothers, good husbands and wives, and who can grow up as time would have it, if time is to go on, because we are nearing the end of our age. But if time was to go on, it would produce new leadership for the Church of God going forward. And that's why we are so vigorous in developing these educational programs, so that we can teach and train. And that leads then into the topic that I wanted to talk to you about. It's the fountain of leadership. Where does leadership come from? Sometimes I think people get in the mode where they think if we just chant leadership, 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 and we label this program leadership and that program leadership, that that will produce leaders. I think that's counterproductive. There is something else that comes first, and that's what we're going to look at today. What it is that will generate leaders, that will train leaders, that will build leaders. What do we need to do first? Let me give you two examples. First, the example of Solomon, and then second, the example of Christ himself during his human life. Let's go to 1 Kings chapter 3 for Solomon. 1 Kings chapter 3. Now, this is the beginning of Solomon's reign. Remember, 1 Samuel is mostly about Samuel. 2 Samuel is about Saul and David. Samuel is still the judge, of course, up and toward the end of it. And then 2 Samuel is the bulk of it, though, is about King David. And then 1 Kings is about Solomon, or a good share of it is, and then it gets into the rest of the kings of Israel as time goes on. So here we are in chapter 3 of 1 Kings. We want to look at verse 7 through 12 of chapter 3. And this is the famous time when Solomon had gone to Gibeon, which was north of Jerusalem a little ways. And he had apparently the altar of burnt offerings was there at that time, and he offered a sacrifice. And he prayed to God then, and it says in verse 5 that at Gibeon the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night. And in this vision that he had in his dream, God said, "Ask, what shall I give you?" You know, in one sense, we might wish that God had given us that, and it would appear to each of us like that. And by the way, in a general sense, he does. Not in the dramatic sense then, but we have the entire Word of God here. Every way you can think about that in the middle of the night. And Solomon said, "You have shown great mercy to your servant. I would like a BMW. Now hold it. I'm the one making this up. I don't like BMWs or Mercedes. They're too expensive to repair. I would like a Land Rover. But not the new ones. They're too sissified. I want a long wheelbase Defender. You know, the big squared off ones, you know." Okay. Solomon didn't ask for that. That's good. "You've shown great mercy to your servant David, my father, because he had walked before you in truth and in righteousness and in uprightness of heart. And you have continued this great kindness for him, and you have given him a son to sit on his throne." So now we come to the passage we really want to focus on. So Solomon is going to give his wish list to God, because God just asked him, "What would you like?" "Now, O eternal my God, you have made your servant king instead of my father David." In other words, David has died and now I'm the king. "But I am a little child." Now, how old was Solomon when he became king? Probably in the neighborhood of about 30 or so, or in that ballpark anyway. "I'm a little child. I don't know how to go out or come in." And you think, what does that mean? Go out and come in. There's a door, is what it's called. So you go out and you come back through it. You come in. No, that's not what he meant. He meant how to go out in front of the people to lead them, how to come back in and make judgments, you know, in the court that he would have to preside over, because he was both executive leader as well as basically the Supreme Court of the land. I don't know how to go out or come in. And your servant is in the midst of your people, whom you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to be mentioned or counted. Therefore, and here comes his request, give to your servants an understanding heart to judge your people, that I might discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of yours? When you stop and think about that, whoa, that was a right attitude on Solomon's part. Now, granted, Solomon went astray later. I think at the end of his life, he came back to this point in his thinking, and that's what Ecclesiastes is all about. But he asked for an understanding heart and the ability to discern or to judge between good and evil, to know what was good and what was wrong, what was not good, and how to judge God's people, how to give them direction. In other words, he was asking for what we would summarize as wisdom and understanding. But the understanding part is more than what we think of as understanding, which is the interrelationship of knowledge. Understanding heart was a broad mind to know a lot of things, and from that to extract lessons and wisdom and bring all that to bear on whatever was being decided. That's what Solomon asked for. He was being given leadership, and what did he ask for? Wisdom. Because he knew that if he didn't have wisdom, he wouldn't be a leader that would be worth, in modern colonial terms in America, the powder and lead it would take to blow him up. Which, by the way, is one of the muzzleloader proverbs of America. We got a few of those. Solomon asked for a wise and understanding heart. So when faced with leadership, he didn't ask for the glory of leadership, but he asked for wisdom. Now let's go to chapter 4 and look at a couple of other tidbits here about his wisdom. Begin in verse 20. Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand of the sea in multitude, eating and drinking and rejoicing. So Solomon reigned over all of his kingdoms. It was a large people that he had to govern. It's just like he pointed out to God. And it gives an example here of the size of coordinating this. Now, verse 25, now Solomon's provision for one day was 30 cores of fine flour. I forgot to look up how much a core is, but it's a lot. 60 cores of meal, 10 fatted oxen, 20 oxen from the pastures. So you have the ones that were brought in and fattened up a little bit, and then the others that are what we call grass-fed beef. And 100 sheep, besides deer and gazelles and roebucks and fatted fowl. That was what the court of Solomon needed every day going through their kitchens. So it gives you a sense of this is a pretty significant operation here. This was not just a little city-state. This was a nation of substance and size for its day. And then we read the wisdom that God gave him to be able to judge God's people at that time. In verse 29, God gave Solomon wisdom and exceedingly great understanding and largeness of heart like the sand on the seashore. The people were as numerous as the sand on the seashore, so he had largeness of heart like the sand on the seashore for largeness. That means an expansive mind. He had an eager mind to learn things. He wanted to learn. Now, God can give you that kind of a mind, and then you can sit around on it and not use it. But Solomon used his mind, as we're going to see. Thus, Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the men of the East and all the wisdom of Egypt. Now, you say, who were the men of the East? Generally, that was referring to in Solomon's day, which, let's see, he became king about 970 B.C. When you think of right in the center of King David, about a third into the King David's reign, if you can remember 1000 B.C., that would be the time of King David. Solomon became king in 970 B.C. because you're counting down in B.C. And then he died in 930 because he ruled for 40 years. So his wisdom excelled the wisdom of the men of the East. At that time, the men of the East were, interestingly, descended from Esau. They were the Edomites. Edom is derived from Esau somehow. And they had a reputation for wisdom. We know that because Job, one of Job's three friends, was Eliphaz the Temanite. You think, yeah, he's one of Job's three friends. They weren't very good friends. Right, they weren't. And, you know, they had some flaws in their logic. Occasionally, they had some good points, and you read their sections of the book. But he was a Temanite. Teman was one of the sons of Esau. So he was a descendant of Teman. Thus, he was a wise man, and the others may have been from the area of Esau too, but Eliphaz particularly. In Arabia, and this would be then among the tribes of Ishmael. They would also be east of Jerusalem. Remember, directions in the Bible are oriented to from Jerusalem, unless otherwise stated. So it would be to the east would be Arabia, Esau, or Edom in Arabia. And the Arabians had a measure of wisdom. And that's not uncommon among the Ishmaelites when they aren't fighting everybody and fighting each other. They have produced some wisdom in their day. So Solomon's, though, at the time, he excelled all the best thinkers in and around where he lived, and all the wisdom of Egypt. And we are aware of the magicians that Solomon and, or rather that Moses and Aaron had confronted many years before, because that would have been about 1440 B.C. when they were getting ready for the Exodus, and they were confronting the magicians of Pharaoh, or the Magi. That's where we get the word magician, which is a term that is typically used for wise men, soothsayers, and, you know, pagan priests are sometimes that get tagged into that category, but it tends to be used for wise men. It's just that God's wisdom was better than Egypt's wisdom, and he defeated all their wisdom with Aaron and Moses repeatedly. But still, they were a substantial culture, and they did produce some amazing thinkers. Solomon put them all to shame, relatively speaking. You know, he was wiser than all of them. He was wiser, goes on to say in verse 31, he was wiser than all men, including, so now we get the next four wisest men, including Ethan the Ezrahite, and Heman, and Chalcol, and Darda, the sons of Mahal. And you think, who in the world are they? Well, that's a whole other sermon. So I don't think you're probably interested to know who they are right now. But they were wise men, and they were from Israel. I'll tell you that much. They were from Israel. My theory here, and when you hear the other sermon someday, you'll hear it again. Maybe you'll forget what I said here, and then it'll be all new to you then. But they were probably his tutors, those four. Why would they be singled out as to him being wiser than them, singled out by name? And when it says the sons of Mahal, it's very, very likely that that is a reference to a previous wise men of the past in Israel's history who had a reputation, and that they studied. It doesn't, because when you study their names and genealogies, it doesn't go back to a man named Mahal, as far as we can tell. We have, you know, limited genealogies in the Bible about that, but very likely it was a school of thought developed by Mahal. But whatever the case, these four were considered to be the next four wisest men in the world, and they're all Israelites. And therefore, it is logical that David had them tutor Solomon, considering that God singles them out here. And his fame was in all the surrounding nations, and he spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. How many of you have written a song? Okay. Oh, come on. Get hand up where we can see it if you've written a song. It doesn't have to be a great song, or a poem. A poem will categorize as well, because that could be turned to a song. I wrote a poem. In fact, I'm a published author. Yeah, I earned $25 for a poem one time. It was about archery and what I missed. But anyway, that's the only one that was worth anything. I wrote a few others, but I don't think any of us have written 1,005 songs. Some of the Psalms, actually, in the book of Psalms were written by Solomon, according to Jewish tradition. Certain ones, and they're identified when you go through the commentaries. But 3,000 Proverbs he spoke, and he collected Proverbs, too. So the Proverbs we have in the Bible are, many of them are directly from Solomon. Many are from the collections of Proverbs that Solomon picked. He would pick wise sayings who others had said. Chapter 30 and 31 are cases in point, where he specifically lists these are from so-and-so and what he said. Because it was brilliant. It was very wise, in line with God's way and everything. But notice what else he talked about. And he also spoke of trees. Didn't say spoke to the trees, he spoke of the trees. And we look out the window and we see trees. And we think, so what do you speak when you speak of trees? Do you speak of shade and green? Or if it's fall, yellow? No, he spoke of the details of the trees, like, I think, the white pine that's right there, which is remarkable for its medicinal qualities. The needles can be boiled into tea that has medicinal qualities as well as a good source of vitamin C. The inner bark paste is not only nutritious, but also has more additional qualities. The turpentine extracted from the tree is remarkable. I just read an article about white pine. You know, and I didn't ever respect that tree until now. I admire it. But Solomon could go on and on. And then he could say, and you see that one over there? And he would tell you all about that one. And then he would point in another direction to some little scrawny tree, and he'd tell you about that. He would have been able to tell you about Taxol before they developed interferon for cancer treatment. It comes from the bark of the yew tree. In fact, after they slaughtered the bulk of the yew trees in the state of Oregon, which was one of our mainstays of yew tree production, they found out, finally, that they didn't need the bark. They could use the needles. And it didn't matter if it was the yew, the Pacific yew, or the yew trees that grew in the Orient, which were shrubs. They aren't big trees at all. It's all the same. It all has the same stuff in it, and it's one of the few cancer medications that are really fairly successful, mainly because of its source, I think. Solomon knew all kinds of things about trees. He spoke for the cedar tree of Lebanon, which was one of the biggest in that part of the world at the time. We had four or five of those growing on the Brickwood campus of Ambassador College. When we were there in the 70s, they were 400 years old. They were planted at the time of Oliver Cromwell. Magnificent trees. To the hyssop, which you would think, well, that's not really a tree, is it? No, but it's a plant that springs out of the rocks. It's like a lichen that grows in the rocks of rock walls. Or on rocks in general. And he knew all about that. So he knew about everything in between. And he could spoke of animals, of birds, of creeping things, and fish. So he knew his animals, of all, whatever kind of animals, carnivores and the herbivores. He knew about all the birds. He knew about all the fish. He even knew about all the bugs and the worms and the snakes. Solomon knew it all. He was a phenomenal naturalist. And you think, So how did that help him be a wise leader to guide God's people? If you understand the nature of God's creation, you understand an awful lot. And there's a rich well of wisdom to draw from. If you don't understand the natural world that God created, then your wisdom, your intelligence, frankly, is limited dramatically. Computers can't help you. iPods can't help you. You have to go and look at stuff and remember it. Now, Google can occasionally help you find something, but to really be wise, you need to have stuff here so that it distills down to bring you a principle that's applicable and valuable. You understand that if you understood the nature of creation, you probably understood some other natures. But that's another sermon, too. It's the five great natures. But human nature, we know that. If we understand human nature, we can anticipate how people will tend to react to different things. Now, when we say human nature, we mean the nature of man, which is not as bad. You know, mother love and father love and romantic love that brings together people in marriages. We understand that's not the evil part of it. The evil part of human nature is the selfish desire, selfish drive But that is taken to a whole new level of evil when we get subjected to the broadcasting of Satan. It was talked about somewhat here in the sermonette. Huge amount of evil wisdom that emanates from Satan. All the nations of the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom came to hear the wisdom of Solomon. But it was those four men, Ethan, Heman, Chalcol, and Darda, who I believe were the tutors of Solomon. So before he came to the point that he assumed the throne of Israel, he had been prepared. He had been taught wisdom, and now he was ready to lead. And even with the wisdom that he had, he said, I'm still a child. Now, a grown man thinks he's a child as far as judging your people and giving them wise leadership. And so he asked God, when God gave him the opportunity for whatever he wanted, great blessings, he asked for more wisdom. Wisdom, then, is the fountain of leadership. Now let's go to Jesus Christ himself as when he was on earth going through his human life. In Luke chapter 2 is one of our main sources of, or the largest single source of his youth and childhood. Luke chapter 2. Now, notice in verse 39, a little short paragraph here. So when they had performed, Joseph and Mary had performed all the things according to the law of the Lord. You know, they brought the baby Jesus to the temple and the certain sacrifices that are made. And Simeon was there. He was a prophet. And Anna, the prophetess, was there and praised the Christ child. Now, what is not mentioned here is that, and I think Matthew covers that, they went to Egypt first, before they went back to Nazareth, because God told them to go to Egypt, and I will tell you when to come back to Nazareth. So Luke compresses the story. So when they'd done all the things according to the law of the Lord, they returned to Galilee. Well, one of the laws of the Lord was, go to Egypt and come back when I tell you. And they did that too. Now, how long were they in Egypt? Maybe months, maybe a year, we don't know. Well, their home was in Nazareth, so they ultimately came back to Nazareth. That was to avoid the purge of babies born in Bethlehem that Herod the Great had instituted, that very tragic, horrible thing. And the child grew and became strong in spirit as a child, filled with wisdom as a child, and the grace of God was upon him. In this case, God's favor. You know, he learned things. Some children learn things very quickly. The Dunkels, little baby Connor, is learning verbal skills faster than mom and dad can't cope with it sometimes. And we're watching some of the, what we call them, the mini campers, the babies of staff members or little children, especially when they're about four or five little toddlers. And they're a handful, so one of the moms supervises them so that the rest of the parents can do their duty as far as other camp staff challenges that they have. But it's amazing to watch those little minds learn. But Christ, as a child, was growing in wisdom. And some children you see do that. They process things and learn lessons from things without having the lessons spelled out to them. And Christ obviously was of that ilk. Undoubtedly, this was enhanced by the faithful instruction of loving parents, Joseph and Mary, who taught what they could teach, which was a lot. And you consider the high compliments that both were given. Then we drop down a little further. You remember the incident when they went to the Passover. Jesus is 12 years old. They go home and they can't find him after they traveled an entire day. It takes a couple of 2 to 3 days of hiking to get back to Nazareth from Jerusalem after the feast days. And they'd walked a whole day with, you know, the general group that were traveling from Nazareth, and then they thought, well, he's got to be with somebody. You know, he won't be in trouble because he's a responsible young man at 12 years old. I don't know how many of you with 12-year-olds feel that way about your kids now, because we have an age that has not instilled wisdom. It doesn't think about wisdom at all. It thinks about bossing people around, just about leadership, not about wisdom. But there are probably some that are responsible. Then they wouldn't find him. Then they got worried. They raced back to Jerusalem. That took most of the day, and they spent a total of 3 days with going back looking for him. And finally, the third day, they found him. He'd been in the temple the whole time, in the temple compound, which was kind of the university center of Judea at the time. And he was engaged in theological discussions with the leading doctors of the law, the leading rabbis of the teachers of the time. And, of course, that's when he said, "Why did you seek me? Did you not know I must be about my Father's business?" up in verse 49. And then verse 50, "But they did not understand the statement that he spoke to them." He's 12 years old, and he's gone over his mom and dad's head as far as the depth of meaning. "Then he came down to them," in verse 51, "and came to Nazareth and was subject to them. But his mother kept all these things in her heart." Probably told them to Luke when he interviewed her to write this book. "And Jesus increased in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man." From 12 years old on up, and he was about 30 when he began his ministry. So Jesus prepared for his ministry by gathering wisdom, studying wisdom, drawing wisdom from all that he experienced and that he learned. So he increased in wisdom and stature. And you think, what do you mean he grew up? How tall was he? Doesn't mean that. Doesn't mean stature. Actually, the Greek word is aeon, from which we get the term age. And you think, well, what has that got to do with stature? Well, he understood his age. He understood its principles and moral failings too. Christ was very aware of the world around him, what it had that was valuable and what it had that was not good. We also need to grow in that kind of wisdom, no matter how old we are physically, and stature. We need to understand our age and be able to pick out what is actual wisdom being taught. Occasionally that happens, less and less as we go on, of course. And to be able to pick out what in fact is not truth, the wrong philosophies of the world, and be able to tell the difference between the two. That's what Solomon asked for. But the point is that Jesus had wisdom when he began his ministry. Look at verse 4. Sorry, not verse 4. Chapter 4, which is a quotation from Isaiah. "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me." This is in verse 18 of Luke 4. "Because he has anointed me." Jesus is reading this out of Isaiah when he began his ministry. The official launch of his ministry was in Nazareth. "He has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, and set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord." And we read that, and that's profound, and it's from Isaiah. But there's another prophecy back in Isaiah that talks about the start of Christ's ministry. It's in chapter 11. Isaiah chapter 11, right at the beginning. You know chapter 11 because that's where the lion will lie down with the lamb and the little child will lead them, right? Wrong. It's the wolf and the lamb. It's not a lion. Our church seal of the past was in error. Not bad error, because, you know, the lion was mentioned in the prophecy and the child was mentioned. But it isn't a lion and a lamb. It's a wolf and the lamb. Lions don't bother eating lambs. They're too small. They eat oxen or buffalo. They're more a lion's appetite. But verses 1 and 2, we're back away from that. Go back to the launch of Christ's ministry. "There shall come forth from a rod from the stem of Jesse." So Christ came forth, you know, he was born in that sense, but he also then came forth when he started his ministry and began to be noted by others. And he was a rod from the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots, out of Jesse's roots, and the Spirit of the Eternal shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, a spirit of counsel and might, the spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord. So we find then that when Christ was ready to start his ministry and assume his leadership as the Messiah, he had prepared by studying wisdom. Once again, wisdom was the fountain of leadership. And that's the big lesson from that. Also, there's a lot of extra fascinating things. Now, let's look at the relationship between God and wisdom. First, we'll look in Colossians chapter 2. Colossians 2, which is a summary of the connection between God the Father and Christ and wisdom. Chapter 2 of Colossians, and beginning in verse 2. Well, let's pick it up in verse 1 just to get a little bit of context. For I want you to know what a great conflict I have for you and those who are in Laodicea, and for as many as have not seen my face in the flesh. This is Paul writing to the congregations in Asia Minor. Laodicea was a town that was there. That their hearts may be encouraged, being knit together and attaining to all the riches of the full assurance of understanding and to the knowledge of the mystery of God, both of the Father and of Christ, in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. So here we have the discussion of wisdom and understanding and knowledge, all centered from around and in that sense emanating from God the Father and Jesus Christ. Now please note as an aside, the knowledge of the mystery of God, both of the Father and of Christ. See, there is a heresy that is circulating in the church, has been for a little while, and it circulated periodically then, that Jesus Christ is not eternal God, and that he didn't exist before his human birth, or that he was an angel, which is what another denomination teaches. Not so. Christ and the Father are eternal beings who form the Godhead, the God family. They have always been. And from them, as it says here, come all the hidden treasures of wisdom and knowledge. Thus, in verse 8, we go on with what Paul was leading up to, an admonition to the brethren there and to the brethren now. Beware, in verse 8, lest anyone cheat you through philosophy and empty deceit. King James, vain deceit. Now we know vain to mean empty. According to the tradition of men. In other words, there is a wisdom of man that is not the wisdom of God. And it sounds good sometimes. You know, we've had that bandied around. The sexual revolution of the 1960s, the drug revolution of the 1960s, the hardcore feminist movement. You know, granted, there were bits and pieces of true values in that movement, but there was a lot that wasn't. Sexual revolution was all bad. Drug revolution was all bad. And yet, many think that's what it should be. Evolutionary thinking. You think, oh, that's passé. No, it's not. It's militant. It has never been militant in the popular society until 2009. And then it launched. I don't know who's bankrolling it. Why would anybody be evangelistic about evolution? It's the stupidest thing you ever heard of. But then again, it is as it is. But there are people who are militantly paying to advertise atheism like it's a religion, which it is, actually. Evolution is its doctrinal base, which is all false. So we need to be able to have wisdom to recognize empty deceit. That's empty deceit. Empty philosophy, the traditions of men, according to the basic principles of the world. Okay, so what are the basic principles of the world? Well, those come from understanding human nature, especially the human nature that is deceived and accelerated by Satan. Well, we can definitely understand that. And not according to Christ, because that's where the wisdom is with Christ and the Father. So the traditions, the thinking, the philosophy has to come from Christ and from what he taught. So we have to, in order to serve God better, all assemble that kind of wisdom. Wisdom springs from the infinite depths of the God family. All the supposed wisdom of the world must be weighed against the true divine wisdom. And if it doesn't stand up to the test of true and divine, then it's not wisdom. It's baddom or something like that. It's falsehood. Now, let's go back for a little poetic interlude here in Proverbs chapter 8. switch from the letter to the poetry of the Bible. Proverbs 8. This is about wisdom. Now, all Proverbs is about wisdom, but this is one particular magnificent piece about wisdom. Does not wisdom cry out, and understanding lift up her voice? This was verse 1. Now, verse 2. She takes her stand at the top of the high hill, beside the way where the paths meet. She cries out by the gates in the entry of the city. You know, where people come and go, there is wisdom to be had if you're perceptive. You're going to learn some of the right things to do and some of the wrong things to do. And at the entrance of the doors, to you, O men, I call, and my voice is to the sons of men. You simple ones, understand prudence. You fools, be of an understanding heart. Listen, for I will speak of excellent things. And from the opening of my lips will flow right things, for my mouth will speak truth. Then we'll drop down and pick up verse 12. I, wisdom, dwell with prudence. And find out knowledge, you know, what is actual knowledge, true knowledge, and is discretion. The fear of the Lord is to hate evil. Pride and arrogance and the evil way and the perverse mouth I hate. Who is the I? The I is still wisdom personified. And then the connection between wisdom and God the Father and Jesus. In verse 22, the Eternal possessed me at the beginning of his way. Before his works of old, I have been established from everlasting. From the beginning, before there was ever an earth, when there were no depths, as in the oceans, I was brought forth. When there were no fountains abounding with water, the springs and rivers. Before the mountains were settled, before the hills, I was brought forth. While as yet he had not made the earth or the fields or the primal dust of the world, when he prepared the heavens, I was there. It says that God created the heavens and the earth. Well, the heavens got created first, then the physical part of the planets, apparently, and maybe the stars. So God, wisdom was right there with God, and it was because it was God's wisdom, of course. But it's a beautiful poetry to describe this. When he prepared the heavens, I was there. When he drew a circle on the face of the deep. What do you mean a circle? You don't have a circle with a flat earth. That's right, you don't. You have a circle with a round earth. This is the Bible science lesson. The earth is round. It's always been round. And those who had wisdom knew it. He drew a circle on the face of the deep. He established the clouds above. He strengthened the fountains of the deep. He assigned the sea to its limits, so that the waters could not transgress his command. What commands? Well, how about the commands of the laws of physics? Water seeks its own level, and it can't go beyond that. Gravity, and any of the other laws of physics that God created to maintain the creation that he made. He made the creation, and he made the laws. So where do the atheists go wrong? They can't stand a moral law. A spiritual law, the law of God in particular, they can't stand that. That's why they're so evangelistic. However, they accept as just basically eternal the laws of physics. And they don't want to discuss where they might have come from. Law is law. All law requires a lawgiver. When Ohio gets laws, do they just sort of pop onto the books out of nowhere? No, those guys up in Columbus make them. And they email them out to everybody. They used to mail them out. Now they email them out. Email them out to everybody in all the municipalities in the state. That's where we get a law. We have lawmakers and sustainers. That's the enforcement end of the government. So where do we get the laws of physics? Same deal. God made it and he sustains it. He's the lawmaker and the law sustainer. Whether it's the laws of physics or the spiritual law. Wisdom was there. The wisdom is, by the way, connected with law as well, as you note. He established the clouds above, strengthened the fountains of the deep, aside the sea its limits so the waters couldn't transgress his command. He marked out the foundations of the earth. There I was beside him as a master craftsman. This is wisdom talking again. And I was daily his delight, rejoicing always before him, rejoicing in his inhabited world. And my delight was with the sons of men. Now therefore, my children, listen, and let me reread that line. Now therefore, listen to me, my children, for blessed are those who keep my ways, hear instruction and be wise, and do not disdain it. Blessed is the man who listens to me, watching daily at my gates, waiting at the posts of my doors. For whoever finds me, finds that wisdom, finds life, and obtains favor from the Lord. And he who sins against me wrongs his own soul, and those who hate me love death. Be wise or die. That pretty well summarizes the plan. So we find then that God and wisdom are always connected, because wisdom emanates from the Father and the Son. In chapter 8, I guess we missed that verse 15 and 16. By me kings reign. Now we're connecting to leadership again. And rulers decree justice. Verse 16, by me princes rule and nobles, all the judges of the earth. So by wisdom is how people lead. Now whether they have predominantly sound and good wisdom, you know, divine wisdom in, you know, various aspects, or more of the selfish, demonic wisdom of the world, that will determine it. But wisdom is where leadership will arise from, because it is necessary for leadership. Wisdom, therefore, is a fountain of leadership. Now, notice chapter 4 and verse 5 of Proverbs. We understand God's way of give, don't we? The give versus the get philosophy. In the give way, the way of life, there are some things that you're actually commanded to get. And verse 5 describes them. Get wisdom and get understanding. Do not forget or turn away from the words of my mouth. Do not forsake her, and she will preserve you. Love her, and she will keep you. Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. We have the command to get wisdom and understanding, but we do not have a command to get leadership. We have to get wisdom. Leadership is given by the institution of marriage within the family. Leadership is given over one's own life, controlling our own impulses and thoughts. That's our primary role of leadership, is leading ourselves wisely. And it is wisdom that we need. Let's look in chapter 1 now and talk about the definition of wisdom a little bit. This is sort of the introduction to the book. Verses 1 through 7 of Proverbs chapter 1. We'll start in verse 1 and 2. The Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel. To know wisdom and instruction, to perceive the words of understanding. Now, the word for wisdom here is, in Hebrew, chokmah. C-H-O-C-H-M-A-H. Three H's in this letter, word. In English letters, that is. C-H-O-C-H-M-A-H. Chokmah. This means, is defined by a Jewish commentator, the Sansino one. It is not sagacity, you know, just philosophical meandering, or abstract learning or philosophical speculation is intended, but an understanding of the principles which control and direct human living at its highest and best. An understanding of the principles that direct human living at its highest and best. In other words, God's wisdom is practical, solid, applicable. It's not the mental meanderings of the so-called great minds of mankind, when they go off and think this and think that and try to be open-minded, which means they try to put God out of their thinking and think of something else. That's not wisdom at all. So shachma actually is the word for wisdom that is used mostly in the Proverbs and mostly in the Old Testament. It's the default word. Another Jewish leader back in the 1100s AD, his name was Amos Moses Machmenides. And he was pretty wise. He was in Spain, but they had kings that sought his advice and his healing. He was a physician as well as a thinker and a commentator on Scripture. Now, he knew a lot about the human body and had a reputation for being wise, a lot about a lot of things. He said, wisdom is the knowledge of those truths that lead to the knowledge of God, lead you to understand and comprehend God personally. The knowledge of those truths that lead to the knowledge of God, that's from Maimonides. If you'd like to spell his name, it's Maimon, the last two syllables are IDES, Maimonides. It could be spelled with an N at the beginning, too. It depends on what dialect you're hearing it in, it gets spelled different ways. It carries the meaning, however, of practical skill or being skillful, having ability in craftsmanship. For example, in Exodus, this is toward the end of Exodus, I'm thinking it's chapter 33, but don't quote me on that. You'll remember it when you read it. It's about Bezalel. Bezalel was the artisan who God directed Moses, to give the responsibility for the construction of the portable temple or the tabernacle. Bezalel, and then he had an assistant who worked with him as well, but Bezalel was brilliant. And it specifically said that he had wisdom in metal, in wood, in gems, in all manner of workmanship in building the tabernacle. He understood all of those things. You know, gemology, he understood that. Metallurgy, Bezalel understood metallurgy. He would have been, put this whole house guys and the Yankee workshop fellow on television to shame, because he understood wood too. He had all of the disciplines down. And the wisdom that God gave him was shachma. So it has that sense of, and being used like that shows it has a sense of very practical application in not just those things, but in the things that lead to the knowledge of God. Again, the key word in the Proverbs, it involves not only intelligence, but also moral integrity. Thus, wisdom means skill in living the right way, not skill in living the wrong way. Now, in verse 3, we're back in Proverbs 1. The purpose of the Proverbs was to know wisdom and instruction. Instruction, by the way, up there is, the word is means discipline. Like people go to university and they study the discipline of, well, medical science, since we've been talking about that, that's one. They could study the discipline of history or the discipline of music. They're referred to as disciplines as often as they are study areas, because you learn how they work, how the music goes together. You learn how history happened and how to track it down. You learn how the body works, and hopefully how to make it better when it's sick. In verse 3, though, it says to receive the instruction, we got instruction again, of wisdom, but this is a different wisdom word. The Hebrew for it in English letters is Haskel, H-A-S-K-E-L, K-E-L, K-E-L, what am I saying? H-A-S-K-E-L. And you think, Haskel, Eddie Haskel, I remember him. He was a friend of Beaver, on Leave It to Beaver. Right, it's exactly the same word. Eddie Haskell's last name is Haskel, and it means wisdom. I wonder if Eddie Haskell was Jewish. Probably was. So to give the wisdom, the instruction of wisdom, and then in the context of justice and judgment and equity, of being fair, of doing what's right, of making decisions that are wise. Commentaries describe it. Again, this will go back to the Jewish commentary first. It means wise dealing. Perhaps insight comes nearer to the original, but in a practical sense, is defined in the terms that follow, meaning justice, right and equity, or justice, judgment, and equity in the New King James. The reader will be taught how to acquire the discipline which will enable him to perceive the line of conduct that is just and right. So it is a discipline. The study of wisdom is a discipline of true wisdom, of God's wisdom. It means to be circumspect, to be skillful, to be intelligent. The Nelson Study Bible Commentary puts it this way: it is applied skill, such as that, again, of an artist or a musician, So it shares a lot of the sense of chachma and adds some added elements of it. That is, wisdom affects living much in the same way that the skills of an artist affect their craft. Being skillful in living, skillful in the godly sense in living. That's what wisdom is. And that's what we need to study and what we need to teach our children and those who are new to the truth need to study in particular and assimilate all of this. Now in chapter 1 and verse 4, we read another tidbit. To give prudence to the simple. And they thought, who in the world are the simple? The simple, from the Hebrew, the word means to be wide open. I mean open to influence for good or for bad. They haven't made any directive decisions. Young people are, to a degree, simple. As if we're diligent parents, we try to get them past the simplicity, the simple position, because it's vulnerable, early. And we teach them early God's way, so they're already thinking the right direction. But we can all end up putting ourselves in the vulnerable position of being simple. You know, we haven't really chosen evil yet, but we are willing to listen to the siren song of sin when we shouldn't be willing to listen to it. That's where simple is. Don't want to be simple. You want to be wise. It is a person of undecided views, susceptible to good or bad influence. A naive person that is in need of prudence or discretion to avoid being led astray. Don't be like that. Think. God gives us all the tools to think. Read His Word, think according to His Word. So, the Proverbs, though, that's the solution for the simple person. They're going to learn to think. To give prudence to the simple and to the young man knowledge and discretion. Then we come to verse 5. A wise man will hear and increase in learning, and a man of understanding will attain wise counsel. Ah, well, that's two words, but it carries the concept of wisdom. He'll attain to wisdom in that sense, as in wise counsel. And so what is wise counsel? Well, the word counsel, or counsels, in Hebrew is tachbulah. For English letters, it's tachbulah. Tach, just like in tachometer. Well, hold it. That's not how you spell tachometer. Tachbulah. Tachbulah. But here, this is really cool. The Hebrew is connected or derived from the word for sailor. It has to do with sailing. And it literally means steering. Hence, the discernment to steer a right course in life. The tachbulah. How many sailors do we have who have ever sailed anything? Only me? Oh, Beth? Okay. Several? All right. Then you know the mystery of sailing into the wind, don't you? If you've sailed, you learn to sail into the wind. And most people think you can't sail into the wind. Oh, yes, you can. If you angle your sails just right and use your rudder, you can force the wind to blow you right into its face in a nice zigzag pattern, which is called tacking. Tachbulah. Oh, yes. Hebrew is the root of the English language. Tachbulah. The word connected to sailing, and that means sailing into the wind. You're steering a right course. In this case, it's a zigzag course because you're trying to climb up against the wind, and you do that by turning the sails and using the rudder so that as the sails are, they're set at an angle, so they're pushing the boat, and then you use the rudder to make it go into the wind slightly. And then you pivot around after you've gone a mile or two, and you do it again, and you're just zigzagging, kind of like going up flights of stairs. Except they're all the same level there. Now, it denotes a practical, moral, and skillful, a spiritual skill in steering a right course through life. The main point, wisdom and wise counsels proclaim the true practicality of Christianity. These are the life skills you want to study and use. Now, we read in the final little bit over the introduction, it says, a wise man will hear and increase in learning, in verse 5, where it was at the beginning of the same verse we've just gone through. The word for wise man is C-H-A-K-A-M, Chacham. And that means teacher. Ah. So the wise man increases in learning, enlarges his teaching. His instruction will be wider and deeper. The bottom line is that you have to get wisdom before you can become. You have to get chachma, the main word for wisdom, before you can become a shacham in the Hebrew, a teacher. Wisdom, then, is the fountain or the precursor to leadership, because teaching is leading. And then we finish off with the last little bit, just because I like to finish it off. To understand a proverb and an enigma, a puzzle, the words of the wise and their riddles, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. If we want to become leaders in serving Christ, leading our own selves first, and our things, our home and what have you, our families, being a positive influence on friends and neighbors and relatives, as far as God's way goes, that's leadership too. That's not the leadership where you get a badge on your lapel that says you're a high mucky muck leader. It's the kind of what we call roving leadership, where you go around and encourage people to do the right thing as the opportunities arise. You have to have wisdom to do that. So wisdom comes before leadership. So the more we teach wisdom, the better our leaders will be. Now, therefore, get wisdom, get understanding, get knowledge. The lessons, the application is study the teaching of Christ. He's the master of wisdom, and seek out what I call the hidden book of Proverbs. You can study the Proverbs. I'll give you a tip on doing that in a minute. But there's another book of Proverbs that isn't called a book of Proverbs. They are proverbial statements, like the Proverbs, scattered throughout the Bible. And if you go and find those, you can assimilate your own collection, especially those that really help you to comprehend things. Here's an example that Jesus said in Luke 7:35. But wisdom is justified by her children. Wisdom is justified by her children. What in the world does that mean? Well, if it's good wisdom, see what descends from it, what comes from it. If the results, i.e. the children, are good children, then it was good wisdom. But if they're bad children, then it wasn't good wisdom. Wisdom is justified by her children. If we're looking for true wisdom, that will be true. It also works on the conversely for bad wisdom. Micah 6:8 is another one, and probably know some of this by memory. He has shown me, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God? He takes on a proverbial status. So that would be one in my own personal hidden book of Proverbs. That would be one I would pick out and copy out to be in it. Habakkuk 2:4, also quoted by Paul in Romans 1:17. Behold the proud, his soul is upright in him, in Habakkuk 2:4, but the just shall live by faith. The just shall live by faith. There's your proverb. There's the key saying. So study the teachings of Christ as far as getting wisdom, and look for the hidden book of Proverbs in the process, in the gospel accounts, as well as what he inspired in the prophets and anywhere in the Bible. You'll find the choice pieces. Study the law of God. How I love your law. It is my meditation all the day. Your law makes me wiser than my unfriendly foes. We sing that one. That's from Psalm 119:99. That is the stanza called Mem. Psalm 119 is a poem and a song, all the same, and it's what they call an acrostic. The first letter of the first word in the first stanza is the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And in the second stanza, the first letter is the second letter of the Hebrew alphabet. It starts with the second letter of the Hebrew alphabet. So there are 22 stanzas. And you're like, what do you mean 22? Well, they only had 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. They didn't have any vowels back in the day. So they had shorter alphabet than we have. Well, whatever the case, that was the one that's called, the letter that's called Mem, begins in verse 97 and goes on past into 101 or 102. It's 5 or 7 verses, forget exactly. Then, so we study the teachings of Christ, we study the law of God, study the Proverbs to swim in the fountain of leadership. Study the Proverbs. And I have several tips on that. Number one, pray for wisdom. We all need more of it. You know the verse that says that. It's in James. James is called the wisdom literature of the New Testament sometimes. James chapter 1 and verse 5. If you lack wisdom, ask God, for He gives unto all liberally, generously. If you feel like you just aren't wise enough, ask God for more. I mean, how could Solomon have been tutored by Ethan and Heman and Chalcol and Darda, the next four wisest men in the world, and not have learned a thing or two? But as soon as he ended up being king, what does he ask God for? More wisdom. So he did exactly what we need to do as well. Now, the second way of studying the Proverbs is what I call issue-driven research. What issues are in your life? Trouble with relatives, challenge in marriage, child-rearing, aches and pains, worrying about the world and where is it all going to? Well, it's in a handbasket. That should give us a clue. But the issues that come up, things you read about in the news. Okay, so what is Christ's opinion on this? How would he comment on this? Then you study the Bible, the Proverbs in particular, but study the Bible to find a principle in one of them. And how are you going to do that? The Proverbs are just sort of haphazardly collected. Yes, they are, or at least they appear to be, which makes you search through them one by one by one by one, skimming down. Okay, this one's about that. Well, no, that wasn't applied to this situation. Oh, but this one over here does. It makes you search through them and find them. Sometimes you can use a concordance for a key word, but sometimes you're looking for a principle they don't key words off of. So issue-driven research. Study the issues of life you're facing as they come up. Your personal topical proverbs will be a great help. So you start collecting proverbs and writing them into a list. These are the ones that are about marriage. These are the ones that are about something else, and something else, and something else. You know, about faith, or about, you know, dealing with communication. I snap back too quickly. I know there's a proverb about that. I shouldn't. I should be more calm in my response to people. And yes, there is. It's chapter 15, verse 1. Soft answer turns away wrath. Harsh words stir up anger. Got to remember that. Well, as you're doing this issue-driven research, you finally find the proverb you're looking for, and since you're focused on that, you will tend to memorize it, or the essence of it. And then it becomes useful because it's right there, and it doesn't have to be looked up. Oh, okay, I want to say something rash right now, but let me see, should I do that or not? And you fumble through your Bible for a long time. I guess I can't find anything says I can't, so then you snap. And now you got to have it here in the head. So issue-driven research puts it in one by one. Study to quote, and the third one is tied to this, study to quote the Proverbs. Learn key favorite Proverbs, ones that really appeal to you. Those are the easiest to memorize. Start with them. And learn them so well you can quote them and use them automatically. Make your own scripture card list. Oh, hold it. That might be a good project for this next ABC class. Proverbs. I was thinking that maybe their next scripture card collection should be World Tomorrow Prophecies. Wouldn't that be fun? Especially if we're getting ready, coming up to the feast, and we're memorizing all these prophecies of the world tomorrow. It helps you really get excited about Feast of Tabernacles. And then finally, the fourth one, or do I have five? Let me double check. The other side of the page. Oh, I do. Okay. The fourth one is dating. The chapter, dating the Proverbs. And that's easy. When you want to read through the Proverbs, and I recommend reading through them over and over again, use your King James, New King James. Those are your basic and best translations available to us in English. When you're looking at other translations, bear in mind, okay, there are other translations. They aren't as carefully done as the New King James and the King James. But they're good for comparison purposes sometimes. So you read it through in the New King James, for instance, and then read it through in the other one. But you know what I think? Hate about Proverbs? I can never remember where I left off. Okay, here's the tip. How many days are in a month? 30 or 31. Mostly 31. 30 days have September, April, June, and November. All the rest have 31 except for February, which has been shortchanged badly. Therefore, whatever day of the month it is, read that chapter of Proverbs. And then if you get to, it's a 30-day month like June, well, you know, what's wrong with chapter 31? You got to read that on the 30th. Frankly, you can read that anytime you like. But double up so you get two chapters on the 30th. But if you just do it, chapter according to the day of the month, you'll always remember where you left off. And that'll give, you know, a prompter for you. And that's a key in getting ourselves to study God's Word, is have little prompters. Now, number five, the last of the ways to study the Proverbs themselves, is a testing laboratory for arguments. And that is when you hear something in the news, or when you're sitting around fellowshipping and discussing things, and somebody reports something they heard, or some quote they heard from somebody in the news media, or in politics, or whatever it happens to be, evaluate how much true wisdom is in that statement. Analyze it. Actively analyze it against God's Word. See whether it stands up to God's Word. And if it does stand up, how far up does it stand? Is there some truth, or is it all truth, or is it very little truth at all? So that's a testing laboratory for arguments. In other words, to remember the Proverbs and to use them, you have to use them. So you can practice by discussing statements or things that you've heard said by whoever it happens to be, on television, on the radio, in your reading of newspapers, skimming the headlines on the internet, whatever it happens to be. You find a statement and analyze the statement as a practice session. Plus, it's a great fodder for conversation on the Sabbath, you know, over a cup of coffee or around, you know, our refreshments after church. A testing laboratory. You do those, if you go after those, and just do a quick summary of those. First, study the teachings of Christ, the Master of Wisdom, and also, along with that, seek out that hidden book of Proverbs and make your own list of them. And then, secondly, study God's law, because the law defines the essence of wisdom. And then study the Proverbs in these five ways. Pray for wisdom, issue-driven research, study to quote the Proverbs, date the chapter of Proverbs by whatever day of the month it is, read that chapter. And think, well, what about Ecclesiastes? When am I going to read Ecclesiastes? The first 12 days of every month. How about that? There are 12 chapters in Ecclesiastes. That's the way I usually do it when I want to study through Ecclesiastes in conjunction with Proverbs. And then practice with them, testing laboratory. Again, if we go after wisdom like that, God will be able to use us in greater ways in various kinds of official and unofficial leadership in the course of preparing for His coming kingdom.